Welcome to LOA Today. Walt Thiessen and life coach Wendy Dillard here. Today is Wednesday, December the 6th, 2017. This is our afternoon podcast. And if you're here for the live broadcast, we welcome you. Glad to have you here. Wendy, it's been an interesting day, particularly since yesterday we had some problems on the podcast with staticky sounds and so forth, and they actually got worse this morning with my podcast with Cindy. But I think I have the solution. I think we're going to have a pretty clean podcast today because I tried something that I thought of during this morning's broadcast, and it seems to be holding. So cross your fingers and toes, but we may actually have a nice clean podcast today.
All right. I look forward to it.
So I'm psyched. We also, well, first of all, we should probably share some wins. I think that's my big win for the day. I almost don't dare to say it, but I want to get excited about it because I think we've got it. So the big win is, yay, no more static on the line.
Yay!
Which isn't a huge win, but it is for me. When you're dealing with the technical side and it's not working the way you want it to, that's a big win.
And it is a win for our listeners.
It is.
Because if they listen to any kind of playback or even live, you know, when we're not dropping anymore, they're going to catch every word we say. So that's
yes,
a win.
That is definitely a win. Now I can't say that there's like two issues, though. The other one about the signal dropping entirely, I can't say that one's gone yet for sure. I'm hoping that it is. But the one that I think is gone is the one where it goes and you know, your voice cuts in and out, and like we get you half a sentence and then half of the next sentence and so forth. That's the issue that I think we've cleared up, and that's much worse because that's painful to listen to.
But, you know, what I know in working with Law of Attraction for as long as I have is we're talking about, quote, the problem, and we're also getting excited about the solution.
Yes.
And I believe that we, you and I, and probably our listeners too, are focused more on what's coming and creating the solution. So really, we're all in this together, co-creating a brilliant solution. So I have no doubt the solution it's on is absolutely on its way.
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, I'm cautiously optimistic. How about that?
Well, I'll let you be there, and I'm like totally optimistic.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm glad one of us is because we need that so desperately. So. How about you? Do you have any wins today?
I'll pull you up into my space.
Oh, well, thank you. Yes. Well, I appreciate that very, very much. So thank you.
You're welcome.
So how about you? Any wins lately?
Well, you know, I had something that I guess I wouldn't call it a win, but I think you probably would. I call it an awareness.
Okay.
And I get a lot of new awarenesses, and I think I'm going to start calling them wins because I really like how that sounds. So today I was having a conversation with a coworker, and this person just stresses a lot about many things and often and talks about it a lot. It's part of her story. And I think I had said on a previous show how, you know, I've spent a lot of time and effort to de-stress my life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to stay in lack of stress. I want to stay where things flow easily and effortlessly. But when she and I are talking and she's telling her story of, you know, stress, it actually starts to have the ability to cause stress for me. And so I have to kind of work at that to keep it at bay. So anyway, today I had this thought and I thought, you know, I'm just going to share this with her. And I said, you know, I'm going to tell you a little bit about how to the stresslessness that I experience now. And I said, I don't know if this will make a difference for you, but I'll just throw it out there. So I shared, you know, maybe for 2 minutes, some of the new thoughts that I have that have taken me out of stress and put me into a state of not worry. Because if there's something, because we were talking about something in the future, and she was waiting on something and didn't know when it was going to happen, and so she was stressing, you know, and she said, I'm going to stress until I get this answer. And I said, but the answer might not come for 3 weeks.
Mm.
And she goes, I know, and that's very, very anxiety, you know, crazy for me. And I'm like, okay. And I said, well, here's what I have done in the past, and this is what I do today. When I know that there's something I'm going to have a lot to plan for, but I don't know when my target is where you start the planning because you don't have all the answers yet, and you're, like, waiting on the answers.
Mm-hmm.
I used to stress and go into anxiety a lot, just waiting and waiting to hear when you know, I get the information I need to start my project. But I came to realize that that stress was very needless, that I was creating that. I was putting that pressure on myself. I was making myself feel bad. And that was really my own personal choice to do that. Because amazingly, people around me, they were like, eh, we'll know when we know. And I'm like, ah, how can you do that? And I realize it's because how we internalize that in our own mind is very unique for each of us.
Yes.
And I started to look at it in terms of, well, let's say I don't find out the answer for 3 weeks. Well, once I learn the answer, then I'm in go mode. But if I were to know today, then I'm not going to know until 3 weeks from now. I could probably let go of the stress because it won't be like I have to wait every day until when it comes.
Mm-hmm.
And I would really like to have a happy day today. And so I realize it's my choice whether I live in a happy space or a stress-filled space.
That's really good.
So, and it really is my choice. But sometimes, and this is where I was before, I was so locked into this automatic go into stress because that's what I had done for years. And how it unlocked was just by acknowledging, I'm choosing this stress. This stress doesn't have to be here. Other people around me aren't choosing stress. So why am I choosing stress? And I just started asking some questions. And for me personally, it's because I grew up with stress. I grew up with my mother doing stress. So I just modeled her. And then I started realizing, oh, wait a minute, I do things really well on the fly. I mean, that's one of my capabilities, you know. Something comes at me, boom, I can turn on a dime and make it happen. So I'm like, well, then why am I putting so much stress on myself? So anyway, I went into that almost like a teaching point, which wasn't my win for the day. But it's what I shared with her, but not that much of it. So in a very small abbreviated thing, I shared with her some of the thoughts that I have that help me to relinquish stress. Her response was made me laugh when I got off the phone. It made me laugh. Because it was as though she put me on mute while I was saying my piece, and then as soon as I was done, she, like, didn't even react, and I could tell. She didn't, like, none of what I said went in her head.
Oh, my.
But here's the awareness, because this, what I'm sharing is not about her.
Okay.
The awareness was she wasn't asking, how do I release stress?
Oh.
She wasn't asking. This was me feeling a little bit uncomfortable with how much stress she deals with, and it makes me uncomfortable hearing her story. And so I thought, well, if I can help her to relieve this, it would help me feel better. But I realized she wasn't asking. And here's what I've heard Abraham say many times, and I know this to be true, but now I've had a life experience that mirrors the words I've learned, which is, when someone's not asking, they're not open to receive.
I would say that's a great win. I mean, that recognition, that, you know, where you make that real in your own life, that's a huge win.
It's huge.
It is.
So I called it an awareness, but like as I'm talking about it now, it's like, sometimes I could just kick myself because I've done that so many times with this expectation that somebody is going to learn from my words of wisdom.
Oh, heavens.
But they're not open.
Are there any of us who haven't done that? That's what I'd like to know. It'd be a really quick survey. I mean, it wouldn't last very long because everybody that I have ever met, I'm sure, qualifies for having done that at one point or another and probably multiple times. So the fact that you made that recognition, that's very powerful.
It was just so funny because I said what I thought were these very powerful things, and it was met with the most blank nothingness response. And I'm like, huh. So we got off the phone shortly thereafter, and when we hung up, I thought about it, and I just started laughing out loud. I went, Wendy, you are trying to teach someone who is not asking the question.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore they're not open, and it's like, save your breath.
Yeah, I think we called on that. Although I have to say, when you were telling her story and how everything was about the stress and everything was about the doom and gloom and so forth, it reminded me of an old TV show. Do you remember the show Hee Haw? This is like from the 1970s. And they did one song every show. It was the same song. And the song had the lyrics. Let's see, what was it? Doom, despair, and agony on me. Deep, dark depression. Excessive misery. If it weren't for bad luck, I'd have no luck at all. Gloom, despair, and agony on me.
First of all, it's hysterical, but it's really hysterical that you knew all those words.
Oh, yeah, I heard that one so many times, it was crazy. But that's what I kept thinking about. Gloom, despair, and agony on me.
All I remember is a lot of straw hats.
Well, yeah, there were a lot of those, too. And a lot of very corny jokes and so forth. But that's the lyrics of that song stuck with me. And, of course, they played it with really happy music, which was even better because, you know, the juxtaposition was wonderful. But, yeah, Gloom, Despair, and Agony on Me, I'll never forget those lyrics for the rest of my life because they are the most wonderful reminder of how easy it is to fall into the trap of just staying negative all the time.
Oh, my gosh, you're so right. Well, you know, talking about hee-haw, that's a perfect segue into what our topic is for today.
That's true. I hadn't thought of that, but it is. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like yesterday, right after the show, Walt and I were talking about just various things, and we started talking about old television shows and how some of the shows that we really loved once upon a time, when we watch them now in rerun, we're like, it doesn't really fly. It doesn't seem appealing, and we flip the channel. But yet we remember really loving those shows at one time in our life.
Yeah.
And so what we wanted to talk about today is how things that we really, really enjoyed at one point in our life no longer has that same zing, you know, where we are today. And what's that all about?
And I'm not even sure where to start, but I guess I'm going to start because this was my first real exposure to television when I was really young, with the old-style cartoons. And I'm going to start there because they were classic cartoons. Many of them are classic to this day. They're considered classics by so many people. And yet when I go back and watch them, not only are they really dumb, but they're really nasty.
Yeah, like are you thinking about the anvils that used to fall off?
Yeah, the Roadrunner.
Squish people?
Yeah. Like, oh, this is, and as I think back, I didn't actually laugh at the time. I think for me, watching these shows was more like, wow, they're really doing that? I just couldn't believe it. I had to keep watching it over and over again to see if the story would change, you know?
Well, you know, I've had a kind of a new love affair with certain old shows right now. Maybe not this moment, but probably about 6 months ago, I ran into an old episode of The Andy Griffith Show.
Oh, yeah.
And I watched the one episode, and I went, oh, that just, it warmed my heart. So I set my DVR to record them, and I just got a kick out of them. And I realized that as I was watching them, it connected me with, oh, if I say a simpler time, that sounds really sappy, but it really connected me at the heart level, because in Mayberry, people cared about people, and there weren't as many laws and regulations. And, you know, Andy, he could just kind of bypass, I know it's the law. You know, Barney, of course, he was very rigid about the law.
Right.
But there was such a juxtaposition between the law and seeing it from a personal people side. And it just really warmed my heart. So I watched a bunch of them. And then it made me think, gosh, I wonder what other reruns that I could watch that would make me feel good. So I was looking for some stuff, and I found Laverne and Shirley, and I found Happy Days, and I found Mary Tyler Moore Show and Bob Newhart. So I started setting my DVR to record those as well. And I found it very fascinating that when I would watch Laverne and Shirley, which I used to love when I was way younger, I went, huh. It feels kind of corny to me, and it just didn't have the pizzazz that it once did.
Mm-hmm.
So I canceled that recording, and Happy Days, kind of the same thing. And of course, you know, my intention is not to say there's anything wrong with the shows. It's just, this is my reaction to it.
Right.
But then I was watching Mary Tyler Moore, and it was a similar feeling to what I had with the Andy Griffith Show. There was something in it that captured my heart and made me feel warm and fuzzy about the people around me and how they created a family within their job, and I just really like that. So it really caused me to ask the question, how come I'm liking some of the shows today and some of the shows that I used to watch today, I'm like, I don't want to see these again.
Well, you'd have to answer that question because you're
good,
the one who has
good answers. Should I share them now or do you want to throw some other stuff in here first?
Go ahead.
All right. Well, I started to realize that who I was at the time I was watching them many years ago is really a very different person than who I am today.
True.
And it was neat in that the television show, my reaction to the television shows really was allowing me to acknowledge how much I've grown, how much I've changed, how much my preferences really are for kindness and love. And whereas I probably just didn't even think about it years ago when, you know, there was maybe cruelty going on or there was critical jesting going on, that was something I grew up with in my home, so I just assumed that was just the way it was.
Yeah.
You know?
That was probably one of the reasons.
I have different choices that I make today in my life,
and I'm not
around people, places, and things where that stuff is present anymore.
And let's be honest, that's probably one of the reasons why those shows were popular and why similar shows are popular today, because a lot of that stuff is still found in the homes. And, you know, it's a fact that society does change, but it can change slowly. And that's one of the areas that has changed slowly. All it takes is looking at humor and how humor has evolved over the decades. And you can just see, you can hear it in the humor. I mean, my favorite comedian, and probably a lot of people's favorite comedian, was Robin Williams. And yet, there was a lot of Robin Williams comedy that I couldn't listen to. It just wasn't fun for me. It was the stuff, it wasn't the lighthearted comedy, it was the really dark comedy, you know, the anger about anything from politics to personal home life to, you know, the bathroom jokes. And there was like this whole dark side that anytime he went there, I would just sit there kind of stone-faced. It just wasn't working for me. It was only the stuff that was really lighthearted that I loved. And when he did his Flights of Fancy, that was lighthearted then. And I mean, I thought that was the best in the world. But I still see it today and hear it today. I mean, if you have like a smartphone and you plug into a service like, you know, Pandora or on an iPhone, you could go to the Apple Music or any of the services out there that give you stuff to listen to, you can bring up the comedy records and comedy concerts and so forth of the great comedians of the era. Just listen to any of them. It doesn't matter which one you listen to. It's all that same kind of deep, dark, anger-based humor. And there was a time maybe when I did laugh at that. It just isn't funny to me anymore.
Well, you know, I can even remember back in right after high school going to comedy clubs with friends of mine, you know, because at that time, where I was living, you had to be 18 to get into them. So, you know, I was finally legal, and I'd go into these comedy clubs, and everybody's laughing and laughing and laughing at what the comedian is saying, and I'm like, I don't get this humor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like I've never used a four-lettered word in my life, but my goodness, if that was the basic construct of a sentence, I'm like, there was no actual content in that sentence. People are just laughing at people saying four-lettered words.
Right. Yeah.
But it was interesting because I laughed because my friends at the table were laughing.
Oh, really?
And I wanted to have fun with them. I didn't want to, like, be the only one at the table that, like, had a sourpuss, you know, on her face.
Right.
I wanted to laugh because they were laughing. And I found myself laughing at jokes that I absolutely didn't think was funny, but it's kind of what I did to fit in, you know, and I didn't want anyone else to know that I thought this was really kind of like dorky. And I know I did that for a long time in my early, probably late teens, early 20s, because fitting in is a really important thing when you're at that age.
Sure, yeah.
You know, but I remember by the time I got into my 30s and someone would say, hey, let's go to a comedy club, I'd say, you know, that's really just not my thing. You know, either, and if that's what you guys want to do, cool, I just won't attend. Or maybe we could do something else. You know, and it didn't matter what we chose to do. But I know by my 30s, I was willing to acknowledge what I liked and what I didn't like.
Mm.
But I wasn't willing to do that in my 20s because I was still, you know, teetering in my own personal sense of security and do people like me, and I still needed everybody's approval,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I wasn't giving it to myself yet.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, I think about that as, well, that was who I was then, and there was nothing wrong with it. It was how I actually was beginning to develop my sense of preference.
Aha, okay. That, well, that makes sense, actually, because as I look back at my own development, similar to yours in the sense that I was still developing my sense of self and wanting to fit in and all that kind of thing, I can't say I was really into the same kind of comedy. We're talking about comedy as most of my friends were. I mean, literally, a close friend of mine and I were the only ones that I knew who liked Monty Python. As far as we were aware, nobody else in school even knew who Monty Python was. This was way, way back. I mean, Monty Python had just started to make its appearance in the United States. And I loved it. I think I loved it mainly because it was so wacky compared to the normal values I was used to living with. And it was just, it was breaking barriers left and right. But as I go back now and listen to some of their comedy sketch routines, I can repeat them word for word, but I don't laugh at any of them. They're just not funny anymore. They're not even close to funny. I can't even break a smile on them, which is really something. I think it shows my own evolution more than anything else because I got to a point in my life where I finally started trusting my own take on things, my own feeling about how things are, you know, my own feelings about what was being passed off as funny. And as I trusted that more and more, then I had nothing in common with Monty Python anymore.
Well, you know, I remember in high school, I guess I hung around with, I don't know if they were geeks or whatever, but I hung around with enough people that on Monday, these people on Monday morning in homeroom would be talking about Monty Python, Keeping Up Appearances, I can't remember all the BBC shows mm-hmm. that show on Sunday nights, and I had no idea what they were talking about, and I felt really left out.
Mm, yeah.
And I started looking for those shows so that I could watch them so that I could either A, contribute to the conversation on Monday morning homeroom time, or B, at least know what was so funny to them.
Right.
And so I remember watching, you know, Monty Python, and I have to tell you, I thought, this is what my friends think is funny?
Mm.
This is not funny. You know, now I know you said it was funny to you, and that's okay,
but it
just didn't really get me, but yet the show To the Manor Born, did you ever watch that one?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
That was one that captured me. I love that program. As a matter of fact, this is silly, I have a Jaguar today. And the reason I have the Jaguar is because the grill on the Jaguar reminded me of the Bentley that was on To the Manor Born.
Let me get this straight. You bought an expensive car because the grill reminded you of a car of a different manufacturer that appeared on a TV show.
Well, I wasn't ready to buy a Bentley, and there are not a whole lot of those in the United States.
No, there are. That's true.
But there was a feeling. It really was the feeling. The feeling that, I can't remember her name, the main character had about owning her Bentley and doing things in proper ways gave her such a sense of aristocratic joy. And I think I was able to embody that feeling when I'd watch that program.
Wow.
Like, wow, what must it feel like to know that you, like, can buy anything you want and you have all this money? Now, of course, the show was based on how she lost all of it.
Yes,
but
right.
But she was holding on to the Bentley because that let her hold on to her feeling of, I'm somebody, and I'm important, and, you know, there is a proper way to do everything. And so I think I just really, I loved how that felt. And because I didn't even know for a long time why I picked a Jaguar. Even my husband at the time said, why do you want a Jaguar? I said, I don't know. But when I stare at the grill of my car, it holds this feeling for me that makes me feel like I'm in a posh vehicle.
Well, hey, if your car makes you feel like you're in a posh vehicle, and more power to you, there's nothing wrong with that feeling. That's good.
No, and I love it. But that was something that I got from the show To the Manor Born, that today, if I watch that program, it still brings up the same feelings for me. It's like I'm still aligned to the enjoyment of feeling that.
Mm.
Because it was about, you know, for me it was about aspiring to wealth, because when I first started watching it, you know, my family didn't have much money and we were always struggling. And so the desire for ease when it came to financial situations was a big thing in my life.
Sure.
So having ease with money, to me, that's what she did. And mm-hmm. even when she didn't have it, she still always found ways to still get what she wanted without money.
Hmm.
And I'm like, oh, I like how she does that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But is that a program that you still like watching?
Yes, I do.
Oh, you do?
Yes,
okay.
I do.
All right. So that's in the good category then.
Definitely. And I own the DVDs, so if it's not on TV being broadcast, I can watch them on my own. Oh, yeah, I definitely love that one. But I have outgrown the need to watch programs because that's what my friends watch. I don't require their approval anymore. I can be odd man out and the only one that doesn't watch those things, and it's totally okay.
Well, we actually have a caller who called in and just disconnected. I'm not sure if that was actually genuinely for the show or not. It may have been just one of those robocallers for all I know. But I did try to answer the call, and we connected the call. So if you're really trying to reach us on the show, please do call in. And for those of you who don't have the number and who are listening live, it's 860-264-5432. Obviously, if you're listening to a recording, that's not going to work so well. But if you are listening live, do feel free to come in. We'd love to have you come in and share in the conversation.
Really? Let's find out what other people are feeling when they watch certain programs.
Oh, yeah.
Because I really think that's really what it's about. You know, what's the other show? Yesterday, you and I were both sharing our love for the show MASH.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's another one that I've watched them all so many times that it doesn't have anywhere near the same comedic effect on me. And I can practically, you and I talked about how we could practically just do the dialogue on any of these episodes because mm-hmm. we've seen them so many times. So I guess addressing the topic of, you know, shows that we don't tend to watch anymore that we used to love, that's probably one reason. I mean, if you know a show so well that you can repeat the dialogue, after a while, it just doesn't have the same impact it had before. You love it, but it's just not quite the same.
But, you know, at the same time, there's some of them that still hold that impact. I've even been willing to, like, sometimes there's a program I know so well because I've watched the rerun so many times that I can turn on the TV at any point within that show and I know exactly what the whole show is about.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been times that if I know, oh, this is the one I love, I'll just sit there and I'll wait for that one moment when a certain scene happens, when there's a certain something. And it just puts a huge smile on my face.
Oh, sure, yeah. Louise and I have that with movies more than TV shows. But, mm-hmm. yeah, there are a number of movies in particular that, you know, it's often one of the feel-good movies, and it's the climax, and you know it's going to lead to this wonderful conclusion and so forth. Like, the one that comes to my mind instantly as we're talking about this is the movie Secretariat, about the horse that won in 1973, won the Triple Crown. And at the conclusion of that movie, he wins the Belmont by 31 lengths, which was and is today still unheard of. I mean, it's just a ridiculously large margin of victory. But when you're actually watching it in the movie, it's like you're reliving it and you're feeling the excitement of it. So anytime that comes on, we just stop what we're doing and we look at that scene.
Well, and I had been, still am a fan of the whole Rocky series.
Oh, yeah.
But there's certain parts of it when he's going through, like, his depression and he doesn't know if he wants to do it anymore. Those certain parts are hard for me to watch because I tend to relate so deeply with certain characters that it's like the moment, you know, he's going, I don't know if I want to do this, and he wants to give it all up, I'm like feeling that. And so sometimes I have to like say, Wendy, this is not who he is. You know what the end of the movie is going to be.
Yeah, right.
It's like, go do the laundry and come back.
Come back at the good part.
After Adrian has pepped him up and he's like, you know, doing stuff in a way that he's feeling confident again. But I find it really intriguing how, especially if you've seen a TV show or a movie before and you know it so well that you know where the points are that are going to cause, at least for me, that cause me to feel uncomfortable versus ones that, like, I was watching, I don't even know if I remember that much of the beginning because every time I've, like, seen it on TV or, like, just happened to be channel surfing, you know, it's in the middle of the movie. And so it was fun because I sat and I watched it from the beginning. And do you know, as I'm hearing Judy Garland sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow, I didn't realize how it was actually an extension of something that had just happened in the script.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, like, in the beginning of the movie, she's trying to tell her Auntie Anne and everybody around her about the lady who wants to, like, take her dog,
Miss
Toto,
Gulch,
from her.
Yeah.
And she's trying to get everyone's attention, and nobody
will
listen
attention.
To her.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and that's one of the motivations behind the song.
And so when she sits and she sings the song, this is her dreaming of, like, she's thinking maybe somewhere over the rainbow, things are okay, and people aren't trying to steal your dog, and people listen to you. And I went, I never realized that that's what that song, that it was actually an extension of the script.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
That's pretty fascinating.
I'm also fascinated by the fact that that song almost did not make it into the movie.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they almost cut it from the movie, and I can't remember who convinced them to put it back in. It may have, I don't think it was the people who wrote it. I don't know, I could be wrong about that. But at the last minute, it was decided, yeah, leave it in. And, of course, it became one of the greatest hits of all time.
Yeah.
But
I mean, because I know tons of trivia about The Wizard of Oz, but I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, yeah, that's a pretty big one. That, and plus, well, you probably know this one. The Wizard of Oz was, and I believe to this day still is, the biggest production that was ever done with a cast that was largely all little people.
Wow. Yeah, that I believe.
Yeah.
That I believe.
And it was an event for all of them, for all the participants, all the people who had roles as Munchkins. It was an event in their lives that they never forgot for the rest of their lives, because it was the first time they'd ever been in an entire community of people like themselves.
Hmm.
So, kind of touching, really.
Yeah, it's very touching.
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting. But, you know, we're kind of on the subject of, like, once was, and here we are now.
Mm-hmm.
What changed? Do we like the changes? You know, what do we hold on to?
Well, I was fascinated. I was fascinated by the fact that you were into the Rocky series. Because, let's be honest, in every single film in that series, Rocky gets beaten to a pulp. I mean, he's like a human punching bag.
Yeah, that was hard for me, because I was not into boxing at all. But I chose to push through the part I didn't like and recognize that it stood for something in a powerful way.
Mm-hmm. Like leading up to
so
dancing on the steps
I
of the courthouse.
I liked how he was a conqueror at the end of every movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know. But even people today, like MMA is a really big, popular sport.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was married, my husband was a huge MMA fan, and he would do the pay-per-view. So we were spending real money just to watch these things live. And he wanted me to sit and watch with him because it was something that he really enjoyed.
Wow.
And so during commercials, I say, it is really hard for me to watch people beat up each other.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they're bruised, they're bloody, it's not looking good here.
No.
And, you know, I'm a Pollyanna. How am I going to be able to sit to spend time with my husband, but watch this thing that to me is so gruesome? And I started to, I mean, I was asking him questions, but he gave me really good answers. And he, to him, it really wasn't about people beating each other up. He saw it as what people had to draw from within themselves to become the best.
Which is
and
true.
To compete at a, yeah, and to compete at a level that these MMA fighters were competing at.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started looking at it from that perspective. And then the next thing I knew, it sort of rolled into at the beginning of an MMA fight, the film crew would capture kind of like what I think they called it smack talk, that they would show them in the locker room and they would have smack talk about their opponent.
Right.
And we would get to see both opponents and what they said about each other. And so just for grins, my husband and I would kind of take bets as to who we thought was actually going to win the fight.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the fascinating thing. my husband was going by their stats because he followed different, you know, competitors, and so he knew how many wins and losses they had.
Right.
And, well, I knew nothing about that, so I didn't base my bet, if you will, on that. I did it based on their smack talk because it's kind of all I had, you know. And here's the very cool part, Walt. I won more often than my husband did in determining who the winner was.
Now, I have to ask you, when you're determining it based on smack talk, what criteria are you using? Are you doing it based on who did the smack talk better, who was nastier? What is it?
Well, kind of like the way I do my coaching. I listen to their tone of voice. I listen to the specific words they use. And the biggest component was I was listening to, are they coming from a place of resistance because they're pushing against their opponents? Or were they coming from a place of pure alignment where they were about themselves and they knew who they were and they stood firmly in their sense of, I have trained, I know that I know what I know, and I'm going to go out there and do the job that I've set out to do. And
yeah.
That positioning was very different than the opponent that would say, I'm going to go out and get them and, you know, I'm going to beat them and, you know, things that weren't about himself. It was really about the other guy.
I agree. I agree completely.
Other guy, and he's not as focused on himself and his own performance, I think he's going to lose.
Yeah, I totally get it. And in fact, I'll tell a slightly different story that leads into a funny story. But since I was a little kid, I was a baseball fan, and I grew up in upstate New York, so I was a Yankee fan. And yes, all you Yankee haters, you can boo all you want to. It's quite all right. but an interesting thing about being a Yankee fan is that since you have lots of opportunities to watch teams do well, you get a sense, probably better than many other fans do, of when a team is going to do well and when they're not going to. And I would have to say what you tapped into, the sense of reading the character, reading the person, reading the player, reading their body language, reading what they're saying, and determining that this person's in a good place, that person's not in a good place, it really does actually indicate who's likely to win. That you see it more often than not just in baseball, but any sport, really.
Because in a way, they're... Without them knowing it, they're letting us know what their mindset is.
Yes.
In terms of their preparation to go out there on the field.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Oh, and by the way,
go ahead.
No, you finish your thought. I was going to take it in a different direction.
I was just going to say, I find that pretty fascinating, and it's what allowed me to watch M&A with my husband so we could have together time. And not be going, oh, I have to close my eyes, you know, I can't stand it. Because I literally continued to watch both opponents' body language, even while they were beating the crap out of each other. And I could tell when somebody was starting to lose their own sense of resolve.
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell when somebody was using what was happening to their advantage.
Mm, yes.
Which, to me, was also very present in all of the Rocky films.
Sure.
You know, of course... The buildup of the music always lets you know what was coming in case you couldn't read the body language.
That's true, yes. They let you know very clearly.
You know. But when I watch Rocky today, I watch for those clues and cues, and that fascinates me.
Hmm.
And I'm not looking at, oh, he can't see out of this eye, or, oh, he's bloody all over the place. It's like somehow I'm able to like not view that part because I'm really focused on the part that really intrigues me.
It makes sense. That's a good way of enjoying a movie, is finding something like that is the good part and just riding it. So that's good. You were talking, though, about how you and your husband, you wanted to be able to do this together, and it was an interest of his, so you were trying to find a way to enjoy it and so forth. My wife and I tried to do the same thing with baseball. And I have to admit, even though I'm a baseball fan, I really don't generally enjoy watching baseball unless my team is playing. If they're not playing, I have to agree with everybody else. It's kind of a slow game. When my team is playing, I can hardly wait. But when it's not my team, it's a slow game. So for Louise, who could care less about baseball, watching baseball was kind of equivalent to watching grass grow. And as a result...
That's what I think about golf.
Yeah, right. It wasn't exactly her favorite thing to do, but you know, sometimes when they're in the playoffs or something like that, she wants to sit with me, particularly the first year we were together. The first year we were together was 1998, and anyone who's a baseball fan knows that's the year the Yankees were absolutely supreme. They won like 125 games. They just broke records left and right. It was amazing. And I spent most of that year dating my wife instead. So when the playoffs came along, I was no way I was going to miss those playoffs, and I didn't. But as we're watching the playoffs, she found a way to make it interesting for herself. And I had just enough tolerance that I could put up with it. So it worked pretty well. Because what she did is she made fun of the players. and to give you some idea of what she would do, the Yankees, of course, are known for their pinstripes. So when they're playing at home, they're wearing the pinstripe uniforms. In her verbiage, that meant they were wearing their pajamas. And one of the players, of course, would, you know, get a hit and run to second and slide into second base. And she'd make a comment like, oh, he got his pajamas dirty. His mommy's going to be mad at him.
Oh, I enjoy hearing how somebody is able to reframe something like that. I think it's funny.
The second baseman for the Yankees at the time was a guy named Chuck Knobloch. And Chuck has a very pronounced chin. So his nickname was Chin. And every time a game started, she would say, "Where's Chin? Where's Chin?"
Hey, I'm all for whatever you can do to find the humor in something. And because she wanted to spend time with you, she found a way that it wasn't just, I'm spending time with him and I have to pretend to smile and like this. She probably actually was able to start to like it because of the story she was telling herself and the imagination she was creating.
Oh, of course, because part of what she was trying to do, she was trying to break through my concentration to see if she could make me laugh at what she was saying about the players.
And did it work?
Sometimes, yeah, it actually did work.
Yeah, I like the idea that baseball players are playing in their pajamas.
They're in their pajamas, and they get their pajamas dirty, and their mommy are going to get mad at them.
Oh, that's good.
And, of course, if they weren't playing at home, that meant they weren't wearing the pinstripes. And she'd say, like, why didn't they wear their pajamas today?
Well, you know, I'm thinking about how – I'm kind of going back to the topic again about how things change over time because we evolve as people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can't help but evolve, but – if you're doing it deliberately and on purpose, sometimes the difference between then and now can be huge, absolutely huge.
Yes.
And like if ever I find myself in a place where I'm really seeking for something that feels more satisfying to me, I'll start with thinking about, well, what used to make me happy? What used to satisfy me in this area? And it's interesting how I could go through a whole bunch of things and go, well, I used to do this and I used to do that. And I'm like, no, none of those things sound exciting to me.
Mm.
I mean, there once was a time that if I was, quote, bored, I would take out a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, get out the card table, and I would work on that thing nonstop for days until I completed it. So I'd go to school in the day. I'd come home. As soon as I got home, I'd be working on that puzzle. Mom would call me for dinner, and as soon as I was done with dinner, I was back working on that puzzle until I absolutely had to, like, go to bed. And then the next day, even, you know, before I went to school, I knock out a couple pieces. And it's like I couldn't help but just occupy all my time with the puzzle. That was very, very satisfying to me. And today, if I go through the grocery store aisles and I see a jigsaw puzzle or if I'm at Walmart and see them, I'm like, huh. Well, I like the pictures. I don't want to do a puzzle. The thought of it is just, like, dull.
Well, the second thought, the one about the thought being dull, that was my reaction from the beginning. So I know there are people who do cross or jigsaw puzzles, and I understand that they like them. It's nice to have some sense from what you're saying about why they like them, because I never really understood what the appeal was.
Well, for me, I'm very analytical. And I love, there was a challenge in being able to visually see something that would fit into something else. And I really like that. And that's a part of my capabilities today as a grown adult, is I'm hyper organized, and if I'm looking for something, let's say I want to reorganize a drawer, and I have a whole bunch of things that I want to put in there, but if I put them all in there and then you close the drawer, everything will shift.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll start to think about, okay, what are ways to compartmentalize this drawer?
Okay.
So that everything will stay in there without everything going through the shifting motion.
Ah.
And then I'll think about how big is the drawer and how many things do I have and how big are the combs or the brushes or the barrettes or all the little tchotchkes that I want to put in there. And I start thinking, what do I have in my house that's that size that would fit in here, you know, that would work for me? And so I am like, oh, my gosh, I'm the best at packing a trunk like nobody's business. And that was my job when I was in high school and we'd go on family trips. Dad would always say, okay, we're going to bring all the luggage out and you can pack it. Because
sure.
I could use every square inch of that trunk and I would just see things like a puzzle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know?
Well,
and
I understand
say, well,
that part.
Little cubby hole there's this little cubby hole, so we got to use that. What piece of luggage do I have that's small that could fit in there? You know, and so to me, jigsaw puzzles utilize that part of my logical mind that loves spatial reasoning,
mm-hmm.
and it was a challenge, and it was very fun to me. And when I got all the luggage in the trunk and closed the trunk, I was like, yes! That was a rush.
It
was a feel-good moment.
Yeah, apparently it was. I can't honestly say packing the car had the same appeal to me, although I do have the similar experience that you had. It wasn't so much that they had me do the trunk. I did it with my dad. Not just the trunk, but the entire car. Because we would do cross-country camping trips and so forth. So everything had to get in. We had to find a way to pack it all in. And my dad was very good at packing. I learned a lot just by working with him. And I got to be pretty good at myself. And you're right. It's like trying to fit together a jigsaw puzzle. Trying to figure out what pieces will go with what so that everything gets in. There's not an unused piece of space anywhere. But I can't honestly say it was fun. It was never fun. When you're done, you say, yeah. When we were done, we were like, God, thank goodness that's done.
Well, and probably the very first time it ever happened, my dad had packed the trunk, and he couldn't get everything in it.
Oh.
And I looked at how he packed things, and I thought, well, he's wasting space over there, and that piece really should go over to the right. And if that sat on top of that instead of the bottom, and it's like, because I'm naturally gifted, I guess, with spatial reasoning, I knew I could do it better. And my dad was very competitive, and he was all frustrated and angry and because he couldn't get everything to fit in the trunk. And he said, well, we're just going to have to put this in the car. And there were six of us in a sedan, and we were going from Chicago to California. And it's like, no, we don't need anything extra in the car.
Yeah, that's
and
plenty.
And I said, well, can I take a stab at it? I think I can figure it out. And he was like, he threw his hands in the air, like, whatever, and walked away. And I took everything back out, and I repositioned it all. And when I got it all to fit, that was the rush
sure.
on multiple levels.
Yeah.
Because competing with my dad, it was a big deal.
I can see that.
Because he always won. And
sure.
So to me, this was like me winning.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I can see that for sure.
Yeah, so, and the downside, or the upside, depending on how you look at it, is every trip we ever took thereafter, it became my job to pack the trunk.
But that's okay,
because I was good at it, and I think every time I did it, I remembered the first time I did it, and I competed against my dad. No, it wasn't a literal competition, but to me it was, you know, and I got this rush. So, and jigsaw puzzles, I think, just utilize that part of my ability to do spatial reasoning and matching things. And interesting, I use the metaphor of a jigsaw puzzle a lot.
Really?
And I see my coaching oftentimes in a similar fashion to a jigsaw puzzle.
Huh. Okay.
Because somebody presents to me a bunch of what might seem like random pieces.
Yeah.
But I fit them together because I start to see patterns.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And that helps me see things that they're not seeing on their own.
Sure, yeah.
You know, well,
that makes sense. No, that definitely makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we were talking about TV shows, and of course, as soon as I'm saying this, I'm drawing a blank. I had something I was going to share that tied into this perfectly, but oh well, there it goes. Goodbye. Just say wave goodbye. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. you know, this is a good time to mention this, that, you know, there's nothing wrong with TV or the media. But I think it's really important to be selective.
Oh, yes.
About what we choose with TV and media. And because whatever we watch and spend time focused on, that becomes a part of our focus, whether we're aware of it or not.
Yes.
And
yes.
So, like, if somebody watches a lot of murder mysteries, and again, nothing wrong with murder mysteries, but if someone's watching a lot of them and really connecting to the characters or really connecting to the crime scenes, it is kind of easy, without realizing it, to get into a place of maybe even fear.
Oh, yeah.
That something like that can happen to yourself. And then it's like the universe doesn't know that that's just a TV show or a movie.
Right.
Because those emotions and fears that a person is experiencing is... then is bring you more of this stuff that you're feeling, especially if you feel it intensely and for an extended period of time.
Not just the universe, but your subconscious mind will draw the same kind of conclusion. It'll assume that this is the way life always is, and that because you keep seeing it over and over again, your subconscious mind is going to be convincing you this is all there is to life. It's just, you know, one murderer after another.
And I just am really, I'm very selective about what I choose to watch. And probably if you heard the titles of the things that I have on my DVR, you might go, really, you're a Pollyanna and you like watch that? But there are certain programs that I like selectively watch parts of it and not others, where I can have it on in the background and then purposely put my focus on at the parts I really want to watch. You know, like there is a crime program called Major Crimes that I love the storyline that is interwoven between all the characters. I don't like the crime, and I don't need to see the bloody crime scenes and bloody crime photos. And I don't. I oftentimes have that on in the background while I'm working at my computer. But then all of a sudden, it's like they have solved the crime, and now it's time to, like, move into more the characterization of how people's characters are evolving. And I'll stop what I'm doing, and I'll watch that. And that's the part that I watch the whole program for, because those feel good to me.
Now, that may explain why my wife watches some of the stuff that she does, because I've gotten to a point in my life where I actually want to limit myself as much as possible to only those films that make me feel good for the most part. And mm-hmm. you know, so when she starts watching, I can't think what the names of these series are, but they're all cop show, murder shows, that kind of thing. I'm hearing them in the background if I'm working in the office, so I still hear them. And when she plays some of them, I have to close the door. I just can't allow it into my subconscious mind anymore. I had a tolerance for it many years ago, but now I just want only positives going into my brain. I think it's because there's been so many negatives that have gone into my brain over the years, so I'm trying to, like, you know, push them aside, so to speak.
Well, and it's still a great practice. What you're talking about, it's a great practice because it means that you're aware of sounds and dialogue going on in the background that you don't want to be a part of what you want to take in.
That's right. Oh, yeah. In fact, every once in a while, if you've had like a tough day or something like that, and you know that happens to all of us, when we've had a tough day, we have like a small set of films that we go to that are really good feel-good films that don't have... They have very, very little bad stuff of any kind that happens in them, and most of them is just one nice thing after another. So we kind of saturate our subconscious minds with that, and that alone becomes a great attitude raiser. Just being exposed to feel-good stuff raises the vibration level.
You're right. And you know what's interesting? Between something I just said and something you just said, I picked up a nuance here.
Oh, what's that?
But we've talked about how I'm primarily visual and you're primarily auditory.
Oh, yeah.
So when you were talking about hearing what your wife was watching in another room,
yeah,
that negatively affected you enough that you needed to, like, shut off the sound by closing your door.
Right.
Now, what I was describing with the crime program that I'm watching, I said, I don't look at the crime stuff that they're looking at.
Right, yeah.
And only when they start having personal dialogue, I stop what I'm doing and watch their interchange.
Mm-hmm.
So that really says a lot to how both you and I, without probably realizing it, we were being impacted. Like, I get greatly impacted by the things I see, but I'm not highly impacted by the things I hear. So they can talk about crime and murder and all sorts of heinous things, and that really doesn't have nearly the impact as if I see something. And I would suspect it's the reverse for you.
In other words, the dominant sense is the one that is heavily, most heavily influenced by negative influences.
Yeah, like if you hear things that are really not good for you, like things that you know you don't like, that probably has a much greater negative impact than if I hear the same thing.
I think you're right.
I could probably say, oh, I didn't even hear it.
Probably, yeah. And in my case, I'm sure it's true that if I hear something I like, like I told you about my playlist, my positive music playlist that I play when I go on my walks, that has a tremendously positive impact on me. It's not surprising that if I hear something I don't like, it's going to have a strong negative impact. Hopefully not as strong as the positive, but still, it's going to be there.
Well, you know, just throughout time, you know, when someone says, hey, have you heard such and such song? Well, I might go, yeah, I've heard of it. And then they'll start telling me the lyrics, and I'm like, well, I'm not that intimately knowledgeable about it.
Mm-hmm.
And something I realized for me is when I listen to music, I barely hear the words. Like, I barely take them in. So I could listen to a piece of music that could have all sorts of negative things being said, and I'm hardly aware of it. But if I like the beat, I like how it makes me feel, then that's what caused me to say I like a song.
Well, okay.
But I've kind of noticed that throughout my whole life, people know song lyrics, and if they start singing it, I'll go, those are the lyrics to that song? Really? Like, as if I'd never heard them before.
So I guess
then when somebody brings it to my attention, now I know them. But until then, it's like I don't hear, when I listen to music, I don't really hear the words unless somebody says, listen to the words.
So I guess I'm safe in singing to you, gloom, despair, and agony on me. Because
yeah,
you won't hear the words.
I just heard the silliness in your voice. That's all I got.
Well, I'm glad you're able to filter that out. That's good.
But I really do know that to be true. However an individual primarily takes in information, that has a huge filter on the effect that it has.
There's
and
no
so
doubt.
Like people, you know, like I go to sleep at night with the TV on and I set the timer to turn it off, and I've had other people tell me, oh, that's not good because you don't want that stuff going into your unconscious mind all night long. Well, I got to tell you, I kind of don't hear it. But I'm also certain that the show that I put on is something that I like. Because years ago, when the TV actually went off at like 2:00 in the morning and
right.
The Star Spangled Banner would be played,
right?
I would go to sleep with the TV on and I didn't have a timer. And so it's not like I was listening to stuff all night long. But once they started shifting it to where it was like a news cycle 24/7, and I'd go to sleep to the news, I'd wake up the morning in a really agitated space because I would have heard the same news thing said over and over and over and over again. So I do know that it does go inside.
Oh, it does, no doubt.
Even if I'm not aware of it.
Yep.
So I'm just really selective about what I have on the TV as I'm going to sleep.
Well, hopefully listeners are enjoying this stuff that is going into their heads, and hopefully it's sticking there and maybe, you know, doing nice things to their subconscious minds. We'll probably have to explore that another time because we're kind of out of time for today. But before we go, do you want to let people know how they can reach you in case they want some more positive influences in their life through some coaching?
Absolutely. I'd love to work with any of our listeners. And to do so, you can go to my website at wendydillard.com.
And with that, we will see you all tomorrow here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye.